Welcome to the Sparkwood and 21 podcast, an unofficial podcast covering the television series Twin Peaks. This is a No Ship Network podcast. I am your host, Sparkwood.
And I'm your host, 21.
Just kidding. I'm Em.
And I'm Steve.
So I guess we should let you know right off the bat that this podcast will be full of spoilers.
If you haven't seen the show, buyer beware. Carpe diem, is that it?
You can do that too. But you know what? I'm thinking that you should just go ahead and watch the series and then come back and listen to us. I think you'd enjoy it more that way.
Yeah, for people who are, you know, virgins to the Twin Peaks experience, we are going to spoil and ruin things for you. We'd love to have you listen to us, but maybe watch the episode, then, you know, or watch probably the first season and then come back and listen to us. We'd love to have you on board, but we don't want to ruin anything for you. It would be a better experience for us and therefore a better experience for anybody listening to us if we were able to be able to discuss everything all at once.
Right, right.
And we're not going to go out of our way to get too far ahead of ourselves. We're going to take each episode as it comes and kind of, you know, examine it like we do in our normal podcast. But we're not going to leave out the good bits if there are any to talk about.
So. Right, right.
Just so everybody knows, I'm aware that carpe diem doesn't mean buyer beware. It was just a joke. It was in the Brady Bunch movie. It's an obscure reference for this podcast, but there, I put it out there.
It was in the Brady Bunch movie?
Yeah, the dad kept saying stuff like he would use these Latin phrases to explain things to the kids, but it wasn't the right phrase.
Okay.
You've never seen the Brady Bunch movie?
I have, but...
It's not worth rewatching just for that.
Memory dump. Well, we're going to go ahead and get into recap. Was there anything you wanted to say?
Yeah, I have a public service message for everybody. I would just like to remind all of our listeners for the duration of this podcast to please stay on the bike.
Okay, so we are discussing Twin Peaks, the pilot episode. This episode was directed by David Lynch, written by Mark Frost and David Lynch, and it opens with ducks in a lake.
Two ducks in a lake.
Specifically two ducks.
Two ducks. There's two ducks in that lake.
And then next we see Josie Packard humming eerily to herself as she puts on red lipstick.
I won't extrapolate too much on this, but I remember the very first time that I've seen, I don't know how many times I've seen this pilot episode
right
now, but back when the first time when you showed it to me back in 99, I remember thinking, what the fuck am I watching? What is this? I really felt, you know, without getting too cliched about it, I really felt like I was getting sucked into another world. It was...
You felt it that quickly with seeing her?
Well, you get the credits.
Mm-hmm.
And then, not her specifically, but there's just something weird and kind of off-putting about this lady just putting on makeup and humming to herself.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the relevance of that scene becomes clear until later. But it's striking nonetheless. But, you know, I felt like I was getting sucked into another world because the credits and the music, it makes you feel this quaint but eerie small townness, you know, that's really specific to the U.S.
So next we see Pete Martell, and he tells a very indifferent Catherine Martell that he's gone fishing. And that's his wife. And, of course,
they're obviously estranged to a certain extent.
Yeah. He's trying, but I think he gave up right there.
I know I would have.
So Pete's outside in front of their place, and he's looking out over the waterfront.
That would be the
lakeside.
Sawmill pond or whatever.
And he says, the lonesome foghorn blows. And I bring that up because we have the I Am a Lonely Soul that comes up later. So interesting. Not necessarily significant, but interesting.
If you've ever lived in an area where there's actually foghorns, they do sound pretty mournful.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah, I lived in Rhode Island for a while, and you would hear foghorns a lot. And there's something that just, it'll chill you to the bone if you're in the right mood, especially if you're a kid, you know, and you're trying to go to sleep and you hear that thing blow. It makes you think of a huge dinosaur or something.
And he notices something on the shore. He walks to investigate. And before he even gets super close to it, you can tell he's wary because he's kind of walking like a crab. But he's walking warily toward it. And then he discovers it's a body wrapped in plastic. And he immediately goes and calls the sheriff. And this is where we meet Lucy and Sheriff Harry S. Truman. And Pete tells Sheriff Truman, she's dead, wrapped in plastic.
That was good. That was good. That's one of the most iconic things, maybe not visually, but vocally or audio-wise about this whole series is just that right there.
Jack Nance saying that
Jack
line.
Jack Nance, yeah. And it always makes me think of his when he played N'Fudd in Dune, and he was like, you're alive, my baron. You know, and he's saying the opposite, she's dead.
So Doc Hayward and the sheriff arrive on the scene. Andy arrives with the camera, and he soon is crying while he's taking the pictures.
And apparently, this isn't the first time.
Yeah, and it's weird because the sheriff is actually such a nice guy, and I kind of sometimes when I watch it, I think this is uncharacteristic frustration that's coming from him. But then other times it makes sense, so I'm not sure. It doesn't really matter.
He's displaying strained patience with
Yeah.
Andy because he really wants to be that's his boss, it's probably his mentor, and Andy's trying to be everything he can be in front of this guy and for this guy, but he still breaks down in tears because he's such a softie,
Yeah.
and
Sheriff Truman probably just wants to turn the body over too.
yeah, this true. Yeah, they want to get on with their forensics
Yeah.
investigation, but I think this is the first hint of a bunch of larger hints and not so subtle hints that you get later on in the show that this is a town where the death of one person still means a whole lot.
So Dr. Hayward and Sheriff Truman roll the body over, and they pull back the plastic to reveal Laura Palmer's face. And both of them obviously know who she is, and they're both shocked and
Upset,
deeply
visibly upset.
upset. Yeah. So we cut to Laura Palmer's mother, who's trying to call her down for breakfast. She runs upstairs, calling and searching for her. She goes back downstairs to make some phone calls. And before she gets to the phone, there is a close-up shot of the ceiling fan at the top of the staircase. It knows.
Ceiling fan, and you can hear the electricity running through it.
Yeah.
I have to say, it becomes a little bit more apparent in later scenes. But Grace Zabriskie, is that how you pronounce her last name?
I
She is
think.
a great actress, and she really, really nails that hysteria and that craziness and that just feeling of everything spinning out of control and the sorrow and the
The
grief.
raw
And
nerve.
but you can see it building up in this scene, and she does such a good job. It still is a hard. Those first few scenes with her in them are still very difficult to watch, even all these years later.
So Sarah Palmer dials a number, and she has called the Briggs household looking for Laura, and that's Bobby's parents. She wants to know if Laura is with Bobby. After being prompted by Bobby's mom, she calls Bobby's football coach to no avail because Bobby's not there either. And then she begins to dial another number. And so we are next introduced to Audrey Horn, who's being driven to school. She's the town's rich girl. At this point, we get a close-up of her saddle shoes. And I read in the oral history of Twin Peaks that Sherilyn Fenn had said that they could not find saddle shoes for the life of them. They actually had to settle for a pair of Oxfords, and they had to paint them black and white. So those are
Really?
painted,
It
yeah.
was that difficult to find a pair
At
of
that time,
shoes?
I mean, you can find them all over the place now, but they didn't have the internet.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I can see that, but it just, I don't know, it still seems like whenever you think of TV productions, you just think of like all this planning ahead. Like somebody should have had that pair of shoes already sized and ready to go like 6 months out, But that's an interesting tidbit that they had to paint them, that
You
they
just
weren't.
send it to the art department and they'll take care of it.
Yeah, true.
So next, opens up with a close-up of a fireplace. The fire is blazing, and we are meeting Benjamin Horn and Leland Palmer. And I think it's interesting. I don't know if that was intentional, but both of those become suspects, and we all have the fire walk with me, and the whole before we meet them, we have this fire blazing.
I don't think that's a coincidence.
Benjamin hawks a substantial loogie into the fireplace.
Then he realizes he's like, sorry.
In that same book I mentioned, he regrets not hawking a wetter, bigger one into there. Because like David Lynch asked him to do it, and he just wasn't kind of getting it yet, And then, in hindsight, he wished he made it a little bit.
Well, you have to have a little nasal congestion to really get a good one anyway. What if he had a clear nose that day?
I don't
It's
know.
one of those things. It has to be more difficult than crying on
Art
cue.
department.
Art department again. Yep.
Yes.
Fake loogie.
So, they're talking business, specifically about the Packard sawmill. And Benjamin Horn says they have solid information that the sawmill is going to go belly up within a year. They walk off to attend the next order of business, which is selling the Ghostwood Estates to some cheese eaters, which is the Norwegians. And Benjamin addresses these Norwegians, working to try to convince them to buy. And at this point, an employee of the Great Northern interrupts to tell Leland that he has a phone call. So Leland has to leave the room while he's talking to Sarah, where he's trying to comfort her about, hey, Laura's probably with Bobby or whatever. That's when Sheriff Truman walks in. And this is where it gets hard to watch.
Yeah.
I remember we watched this. We've watched this with many people. We've watched this with a group of people and one time, and they laughed at this part. Yeah, this doesn't make me laugh. I find it to be very disturbing, but.
I always wondered if it was just uncomfortable laughter with them because, it sounded like it was nervous laughter, like they didn't know how to process whatever like emotions were being touched by, what she was doing, because you just don't see a lot of that in TV.
Yeah, that's probably what it was. So yeah, this was a very difficult scene to watch, as you already stated earlier. They focus on the cord of the telephone to kind of give you some distance from the emotion, but then they bring you right to the Palmer home, and you see Sarah just really let some screams go, and it's like the hair raises on the back of your
Oh,
neck.
that's what I was talking about earlier. She excels at that. She really pulled that off. It hits home. It's haunting.
So now we're at the Double R. Bobby is having his breakfast. We also meet Norma and Shelley. Bobby offers Shelley a ride home, and then Bobby plays some music on the jukebox before exiting the Double R. And Bobby and Shelley are having a secret affair, and they don't think anybody knows.
But it's pretty clear to Norma what's going on.
Yeah.
She's not stupid, and I don't think you have to be particularly smart to notice that these two are kind of doing something behind the scenes.
It was cute though how they both kind of like looked from side to side to make sure nobody could see, and they start kissing. And so they start driving, and they got this cute dialogue about the pocket rocket. And Bobby wants to make sure that her old man is not home, so she's married. Turns out he is, and he ends up dropping her off at a safe distance from Leo's view. And he hurries away, clearly frightened about the thought of discovery from Leo. They are both very frightened when they saw his truck.
And it's been remarked upon that there you can see it on her face, Shelley's face, that she did like such a good job of acting in that. And I saw it here. I mean, I've never thought that she didn't, but I looked out for it, especially this time since we'd seen the extra, when David Lynch was talking about that, and I think Kyle MacLachlan as well. They were both saying that that
On the
scene
special
was,
features, yeah.
special features. And so Bobby spins, he just kind of, which I thought was cowardly because it's like, oh, you're going to get in trouble by him. I'm not. I'll see you later, So he's clearly afraid of him.
Yeah, Bobby's not the best boyfriend. But I have to say, I think Machen Amick is out of the young actresses. I think they're all good actresses. They're all good, very good actresses. But Machen Amick, she does a really, really good job, especially anytime she has to cry. I think she really sells it. Okay, so now we're to Leland. He's brought to identify the body. And we learn that Laura was 17 years old. He sees the body. And he confirms it's her. He sobs, and he's escorted away. That doesn't sound very good. They bring him into the room, and she's there, purple.
Yeah, he pulls back the plastic and confirms that it's her.
Right, and he starts to sob, and he's escorted away. And I just noted here that the sound of the fluorescent kind of heightens the disturbance surrounding Laura's death. That's another kind of like extension of electricity, I guess, or just.
Especially in those hospital scenes, it seems like it's this omnipresent
Like a
thing.
hum, but it's like a disturbing hum. And I don't know if it's like a focus on technology and the way that you kind of find in other, because we cover Penny Dreadful, and we discussed a poem by Wordsworth, and that was during like the Industrial Revolution. And so you had like the whole, where technology is this like evil entity. And I think in a way, maybe this is also functioning in the same way, maybe, but it's just a different time and a different form of technology that provides that scary hum in the horizon. That sounds so
Well,
stupid.
it's kind of like when you stay in a hotel room, you know what I mean? And there's always something that you can hear,
Yeah.
whether it's the air conditioning or the heating
The
or
street lights
the
outside.
TV from the next room
Yeah.
or something. It's just this invasive force in our lives, and it's
Yeah.
just always coming through. But in the hospital scenes especially, David Lynch and the creators, they made it a point to always have it. It's almost in the forefront.
Yeah.
So there's some significance there that you can either read into or you can kind of let it go. You never know with him. You know what I mean? Because he's such a visual artist. Everything he does is rooted in the visual. I mean, I've read interviews with him before. I think you've told me actually where he'll take something, a scene, an idea that he has in his head, and it doesn't have to be connected to anything else, and he'll create his story around that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to say whether there's some sort of significance that we need to be trying to read into, or if it's just existing because it's there.
He's a visual artist, but he also is an artist with sound too, sound construction. So he uses sound, I think, in a way that a lot of other people maybe not use as much.
I can see that in the show for sure.
That was very vague, but I think, he makes
But if we're when
music
you
and
watch the
he
show,
works very closely with Angelo Badalamenti, and I think he puts a lot of emphasis on sound, not just in soundtrack, but also with creating atmosphere.
yeah, definitely. That's the best way to put it. It creates atmosphere, because if you like, the more you get into the show and the more you watch it, if you haven't already seen it, it's like its own character.
So wind blows through the trees, and we are at the high school, and we meet Donna Hayward. She sees Audrey changing her shoes, her little Oxfords, into red heels, and she laughs good-naturedly at her. We know they're not close because we've seen the series, but I think they have a certain regard for each other that's pretty cool. Jameson enters the scene, and he asks Donna if she has seen Laura, and she says, "No, not yet." And he then says, "Nice day for a picnic," like it's an inside joke.
Yeah, and at this point you're just like, what the fuck are you talking about? This is weird. This tough looking biker guy comes in. What tough but sensitive looking biker guy comes in, and he just kind of cozies up to this girl. He's like, nice day for a picnic, huh? What?
It's kind of cheesy. And she says, yeah, and smiles to herself, and as he walks away. And then we have that kid that does the sideways moonwalk through the hall. And then Bobby arrives to school, and he's told that he's being asked for. Mike, who's Bobby's friend, is there, and Bobby is summoned to the office. He's not very respectful to his elders.
Yeah, he plays the petulant teenager role to a T.
I think I
Like,
nailed it, though, when I said he's a soche pretending to be a greaser.
yeah, definitely props for that for sure.
So now in the classroom, we have roll being called, and it's convenient that they all have last names of H. So we could see like Horn, Hayward, and Hurley,
I didn't
or
notice
Hayward,
that.
Horn, and Hurley.
Huh.
And so we don't have to go through the whole list, of names in the classroom. So it's a great way to learn their names.
I don't know how many times I've seen that episode and I haven't ever caught on to that.
This is a minor detail, it's not a big deal. And so a cop comes in looking for Bobby Briggs. The cop tells the teacher something in a whisper about an announcement, and then a girl runs screaming outside. Donna looks at an empty chair, which is presumably Laura's. She begins to cry. James also looks at this chair and snaps a pencil in half. I have to say, I was in high school before, obviously.
You
Okay.
were?
I was in high school, and we did have somebody die. And before they announced it to our school, there was a girl who ran screaming down the hallway. And I was actually in my geometry class, and it was very weird, and it's very similar. But he died of meningitis. He wasn't murdered. But
Yeah, I there's been a few people who I've gone to high school with that have died. I mean, when I say few, I mean like two, maybe three. And I don't know, when people run screaming down the hallways, it's just drama that's more about themselves than it is about anything else.
Did that happen at your school?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just telling you that
So you're
that's what it
saying that girl
is.
at my school was
Yeah,
creating
that's
drama?
what I'm saying. Yep. It was more about, hey, look at me, than it was about grief
I
for
don't think
this
it
person.
was.
You're wrong, but
Okay. Because it
I
was me. No, I'm
yeah.
kidding. No, I really don't think it was. It was a small school. We only had like 20 people in our class. Everybody knew everybody.
Everybody can express grief in their own fashion. I'm only halfway serious, but I think that when people do that, it's more about them than it is about, you know. This was just a plot device. You know what I mean? To let Donna and James look at each other, and across the empty seat is between them,
It's a
which
plot
is.
device, and it also adds more to the atmosphere because it's jarring to the viewer to see somebody, you hear the scream and then you see them running.
You know, you think about Laura and James's relationship, where it starts and then where it goes. Laura was between them, not only figuratively, but physically in that classroom. You know, she was the barrier between the two of them coming together. Now she's gone, just an empty seat. So.
Bobby's being questioned by deputies, deputies Andy and Hawk specifically. And then Sheriff Truman arrives and makes it clear to Bobby that he is a suspect. And Bobby, with some talking about dramatics, with some serious overdramatics, says that he loved Laura and she loved him.
Yeah.
And then the principal makes an announcement to the school about Laura's death. He asks those that know of Laura's activities the day before to come forward. The principal begins to sob. She was loved by all, apparently. And the scene ends with a shot of Laura's homecoming queen picture. The next scene opens. Did you want to talk about her picture at all?
No, that's the picture that ends up being in the ending credits after the show gets like going.
Yeah. She looks like the perfect little princess. Mm-hmm. The next scene opens with the same picture at the Palmer household. Sarah is being subdued with medication. Sheriff Truman questions her about Laura's recent activities.
They don't actually show them giving her anything, but you can tell because she's just like, she's ready. And she's just, because she goes from this like screaming, you know, tempest down to just melting into the couch. And then she's ready to talk.
Leland and Hawk are in Laura's room. Hawk finds Laura's diary and a video camera. Meanwhile, Sheriff Truman continues to question Sarah Palmer when the phone rings. Andy answers the phone and tells Sheriff Truman that there is another missing girl, and it's Ronette Pulaski. At the Packard Sawmill, Pete is doing what? I guess he's counting 2x4s and
4x8s.
Josie and Catherine storm into the room arguing. Josie is unyielding in this moment, and I think this may be the last time we see her in such a manner.
Where she's really standing her ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right.
And we see that her and, well, she does kind of later, but it's different. But anyway, we see that her and Pete are close, or at least he supports her.
Well, he stands behind her when she's talking to Catherine.
His wife, Catherine, right. Who is indifferent toward him at the very beginning
so
of this
episode. So he's making a stand in a physical sense because he's right behind her. He's like saying, I agree with whatever she's going to do, so just shut your mouth.
So Catherine leaves, and she fires an employee just...
That's when I decided I didn't like that character, right then and there.
Yeah, but people change, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I've disliked half of this cast.
You didn't dislike Josie right away.
No, I didn't. That had to happen over time. But that never...
So now we have the scene where Ronette is walking across the state line. She's in a tattered, dirty negligee. Bindings are around her wrist. It looks like there are cigarette burns on her chest, and she also has like large bruise and possibly like skin abrasions on her thighs. A man sees her that's working on that bridge. So now we have James Hurley, and he pulls up on his bike at Big Ed's gas station. And he's so depressed, and it's understandable. His girlfriend's dead, right? So, they have like the most basic communication possible. And the only two words that they said that had more than one syllable was coffee and Donna.
is James Hurley possibly the first emo biker?
Possibly.
Yeah. I mean, this was 1989.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I don't know if emo was really a thing at that point. I think it came a little bit later. Why did it have to come at all?
Uncle Ed offers to buy him coffee. He says he can't do it, but he leaves a note with Ed to give to Donna. Nadine yells at Ed about the drapes, then Ed takes off in his truck to pick up the drapes. They need to be hung by nightfall.
Yeah, and even though it looks like it's almost dusk at this point, it's still early in the morning because everybody just got let go from school, and that's the first place he went.
It was overcast because Cooper says it's overcast later.
Oh, yeah, that's right, that's right.
So, finally, Agent Dale Cooper enters the town of Twin Peaks like a breath of fresh air on an overcast day. He is talking into his handheld tape recorder to a Diane. 11:30 a.m., February 24th, 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 24 miles west of the state line. He had lunch at the Lamplighter Inn.
And I hit up Wikipedia before we did the podcast because I remember listening to an article on the radio the other day and somebody used the word lamplighter or the term lamplighter synonymous with whistleblower. And it was actually... But anyway, it doesn't matter who it was with. But I looked on Wikipedia and it says lamplighter is somebody who is their job was to lamp lights by means of wicks on a long pole. But more importantly, in some communities, lamplighter served a role akin to a watchman. So here we have this man of the law who's coming into this place that's kind of in the dark about what's going on. Because I think people, you know, like I said, we're going to be spoilery. So people are in denial that this kind of thing can happen in Twin Peaks. And you see this in Sheriff Truman's reaction a little later on when Cooper says that you're going to find cocaine in this bag.
Right.
And he's just like, no, it's not going to happen. So he's coming in and he's
shedding light.
illuminating and shining light on the dark corner. So it's kind of cool that he was coming from a place called the Lamplighter Inn. I don't think that was unintentional.
Yeah, I don't think so either. And I think he passes the sign of Twin Peaks, and it says population 51,201. That would be 51,200 now.
200. And he also says that it's 54 degrees out. And
overcast.
I should note that it's actually where we're podcasting right now. It's 54 degrees right now.
Is that significant?
Probably not.
So Sheriff Truman and Cooper meet at the hospital. Truman is glad to have FBI in Twin Peaks, which usually you see cops not happy about having FBI. But in this show, he is. Cooper asks about the trees.
What kind of trees are these?
And then he moves on straight to business. Cooper first visits Ronette, and there's no connection yet between Ronette and Laura that they know of. Ronette may have neurological damage and is non-responsive. Cooper examines her fingernails. He does not find what he's looking for. Ronette starts to say, "No, don't go there."
Now, we know what this means in the larger context, but I was just wondering, this is the first time that I've thought it, out of however many times I've seen it, that when she says, "No, don't go there," could she be talking to Cooper? Like, don't go down this rabbit hole. Don't follow this, because...
Maybe.
You know, I don't know. Just a thought.
I like that thought. Maybe. Truman and Cooper ride the elevator down to a lower level. They are behind a one-armed man dressed in black. Is his arm missing distracting from the fact that he is the man in black? The one-armed man departs the elevator, and there is a loud talking weirdo talking about a fish, a big mouth fish, I think, that he pulled out of the water, and it starts talking to him. So I'm thinking he's talking about a dream he had, and he's speaking very loudly to these nurses. He sees the sheriff and Cooper in the elevator, and he tries to speak to them, but the elevator doors close, and they don't try to stop it. So you cut to where you see the stairs, and you hear him running down the stairs. This is Dr. Jacoby, and he approaches them, and he asks if he can go into the morgue with them. And Cooper says, "Why would you want to do that?"
Yeah, that's a really odd freaking question from a guy who's standing there wearing this. He's got earplugs in.
Yes.
And he has to take them out. And he was talking very loudly to these
nurses.
Probably
why he was talking so loudly. And his glasses, he's got two different tints, red and blue or green. And
is that so you can see in 3D all the time?
So I think being a psychologist, he's changing the way his senses engage with reality. Maybe the earplugs dampen that particular sense, therefore it heightens the vision. And so he just went ahead and threw in some colored lenses for good measure, maybe. It's probably part of an ongoing psychological experiment. And maybe the earplugs kind of create like a isolation tank type feel too, or maybe he feels like he's underwater.
That's some pretty interesting insight. I would have never thought that. I would have never gotten that from that scene. I just thought he was this eccentric kook. But I mean, it's a really good point, because from a psychological standpoint, I mean, think about like going into a party blindfolded and you can only hear what people are saying to you, and you can feel your way around the room with it's a completely different experience. So that's a really good point. So he's one eye is viewing the world through rose colored glasses, I guess, and the other eye not so much.
I don't know really what to think about the two colored lenses, because I mean you're seeing with both your eyes at the same time, and so it's going to affect. You're not going to have. It's not divided.
Yeah,
you know, it's going to be a blend,
you're right?
I don't know how that affects his vision necessarily.
To extrapolate upon your point, I was just thinking of this when you were talking about it. His crazy dress and his hairstyle, and just he looks a little bit like odd. There's something off about him.
Definitely.
He's off-putting. So that immediately puts people off of their game. So they can't be as, you know, their defenses are penetrated a little bit more easily, because they're not, you know, they're not balanced and they're not like completely focused like they would be. If you walk up towards a normal looking person, you're composed, you have everything on point. But when somebody throws you off like that, they can say something to you and your reaction's not going to be the same as it was if they looked like your regular average person. So he can probably get a lot more interesting, we'll say, interactions out of that.
Is that his litmus test for people's character?
Possibly how they judge him, the way he looks.
Very interesting.
But this whole episode, it's while we've been talking about it, we get very, very little like sample tastes of all of these crazy characters. Some, just barely they're in frame for literally a second, and
I
then
know.
they become such large and looming figures in the series later on, but you're just seeing them for just that little second, and it's pretty cool to watch it.
Maybe we'll get to know more of Dr. Jacoby in 2016.
Yeah, it's possible. Hopefully he's one of the ones who signs on.
Yeah, hopefully. But Russ Tamblyn, the actor, it was left up to him to decide on what that character wore. So
Huh.
that's what he chose. Yes, and he just continues to be weird because he reveals that he was Laura's shrink and that Laura's parents did not know she was seeing him, and he laughs like this is hysterical.
Yeah, why would that be funny?
He's got this tie on, and it's got a hula girl embroidered on it, but she has like a grass skirt that you could actually get your finger up on under. And he was had his finger up under the grass skirt, and he was rubbing when he said it. So I don't know what the deal is with that. The actor picked that outfit out, so I'm sure that was a device he decided to use.
And it also, the way the scene plays out, he says, Laura's parents didn't know that she was seeing me. And he leaves the verbal extrapolation of that to go to Coop and Harry because they're like, he's a psychiatrist, yeah, or Laura was seeing a
Right.
psychiatrist. But he leaves it as like, hey, her parents didn't know she was seeing me. Almost like it
It
could
could
be
be something
a
else.
romantic thing or
Right.
something, but because he's not wearing obvious doctor's garb.
Think he was wearing a lab coat.
Yeah, I guess what he comes off more as a mad scientist
Yeah, he
than,
does.
somebody who's going to help you.
So Cooper and Truman examine Laura. The flickering fluorescent light is present. That was a lot of people know this lore about the making of Twin Peaks, but that was an accident that David Lynch decided to go with, so it helped kind of create a disturbance in the force.
It works really well with that scene, I think.
Yeah, and then this is also the scene where Cooper asks, he says, "Will you please leave the room?" And the guy says, "Jim." And he says, "No, will you please leave the room?" And that's to me similar to when later on when they question, like episodes from now where they question Renette and they have to deal with the stools.
Oh, yeah.
That's like real life stuff that kind of pops in, and those type of things kind of get smoothed over in shows. They make it all nice and glossy, and
They take them out, yeah. They take out that kind of stuff because it detracts from the, like you said, the smoothness of getting from story time point A to point B.
But leaving it in actually makes it more wonderful, at least in this context. So then, Cooper examines her finger and he pulls out the letter R. And it's unnerving to watch still.
Yeah.
Back at Big Ed's gas farm, Donna sits in her car waiting. She approaches Ed and they hug. She asks after James, and then Ed gives her a note that James has left for her. And on this note, it says to meet at the roadhouse at 9:30 because he's playing a treasure hunt with her. Mike shows up making demands on Donna. Ed tells him to muffle it. Mike says that he and Ed are not friends.
Because, yeah, because Ed tells him, muffle it, Junior. And
Yeah.
he says something else, and then Ed goes, you're on my lot, friend.
Friend.
And then he goes, oh, Ed, we're not friends. Which,
How does
I
somebody
know.
get around in life like acting like that all the time?
And, to act like that to a guy like Everett McGill, and especially the character he's playing as Big Ed Hurley on the
Yeah.
show, it's just lamentable. He's such a likable character. I mean, even in People Under the Stairs, he was a likable guy.
Stilgar would have taken his water.
Oh, yeah, in a heartbeat.
Let's see here. So, yeah, so Mike peels out, his car does anyway, and Nadine yells about drapes, and Ed says, "Yeah, okay." How many times have we said that
Oh,
in our
like.
daily life because of Ed Hurley? Donna tells Ed to tell James that she is looking for him, and then she leaves.
How did people communicate with each other in the times before cell phones? When we were all just a text away, you
Well,
know?
it's passing messages
Yeah, I
and
guess. Driving out to Big Ed's gas farm and handing off notes about when to meet. He's one flat tire and you're just fucked for the day, you know?
we probably won't see as much of Ed in the 2016 version because they're gonna have cell phones.
Yeah, what is
What
his
use?
part does he
Yeah, is
play?
he? Cooper and Truman prepare for interrogation. They have some evidence that they have taken from Laura's room, like the videotape. He pushes that to the side for now, but and Cooper pulls up the diary, and this is also telling of you got kind of what you were saying earlier. You've got Hawk asked where the key was to this diary, and then Harry just says to Cooper, "We still haven't found the key." And then Cooper just busted open. So he's coming in. Only an outsider could have done that, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I see where you're going with this. It's kind of like that small town sensibility of where you're kind of loath to violate somebody's privacy
And they
or
knew her.
yeah.
So he discovers the line, nervous about meeting Jay tonight, and that it's something to get started on. And then he finds a key to a safety deposit box. It is in a plastic envelope that also has a white residue, could be cocaine. And he says, "Have you ever been surprised before?"
Yeah, Truman says you didn't know Laura Palmer after he said that he's going to find the cocaine. And, Cooper looks at him and says, "You ever been surprised before? Maybe we'll both be surprised."
Yeah, maybe
So,
we'll both learn
or
something.
yeah, maybe we'll both learn something. And it's just a it's a very telling scene. It's this realistic FBI way of doing something, butting heads with this small town naivety about how its occupants actually handle their business.
Well, and then he picks up the small box of chocolate bunnies and he starts talking into his tape of,
Diane, I'm
yeah.
holding in my hand a box of chocolate bunnies.
And I'm just wondering what flagged them, like, why was that taken, you know? And so I would like, if there's any idea or theories out there, please write into No Ship Network.
Yeah, I'd love to hear anybody's ideas on why, but I'm just going to come out and say it right now. I think this is just trademark Lynchian weirdness
Yeah.
at its most normal.
But
That
that's
that's all that
fine.
is.
He features bunnies and other, like, isn't there bunnies in Inland Empire?
Yeah, there are.
So, yeah, if any theories out there, please write into No Ship Network at
Well,
noship.net.
they're not so much bunnies as they are human beings dressed up in jackrabbit suits. But yeah, okay, I guess.
So,
Oh, they talk about snowshoe rabbits later.
yeah, it was foreshadowing for that discussion.
There you go.
So there's thunder heard over a forest landscape, and there's an old train. The Twin Peaks Police Department is investigating, and Andy has called Lucy and he's crying because they have found the scene of the crime, and he says it's horrible. Bobby's interrogation begins. He is bratty in a way that only Dana Ashbrook can pull it off.
I don't know. I think Paul Rudd could have done that too.
Because Wet Hot American
Yeah,
Summer.
cause just because of his role in Wet Hot American Summer. Coop is awesome. He really carries this scene because when he comes out and he's just, being really bratty and everything, he says, "Well, how did, do you have it written down what exactly what he says?" I think he's like, "Here's how this works. We ask the questions,
And
you
you answer
answer
the
the
questions
questions
that we ask
briefly
briefly
and
to
to the
the point.
point."
Yes. He plays the videotape that was found in Laura's room. Agent Cooper asks him if he shot this video. He then says, "Did you know that Laura was seeing someone else? That's what you guys fought about last week, isn't it?" And he says, "Here's a hint. First initial J." And then Bobby says, "No, she would not do that to me." And then Cooper says, "You didn't love her anyway."
The interesting thing about this scene is while he's talking, while Bobby's talking, Coop is writing something on the, it looks like a little calculator, but it's actually I guess a small
Word processor
word
or something?
processor, yeah, but it only has the readout of a calculator, and he passes it over to Truman and it says he did not do it. So he figured out pretty quickly. I mean, he's a great detective. I mean, this is being broadcast to you loud and clear.
So meanwhile, Audrey is up to pranks. She punctures the concierge Julie's styrofoam cup like a little jerk, and then she allows it to spray all
She
over
says,
the desk.
what would happen if I pulled this pencil out? She's like, "You wouldn't dare." And then she does.
She does. And then she goes and pays a visit to the buffet. And she says, "They found my friend Laura." Okay, so I should say that the Norwegians are in there and they're in the process of signing this contract finally, right? And they cannot, and Audrey just overheard that man come up to Julie and say they cannot find out about Laura's death because they will not follow through. So she goes in there and she says, "They found my friend Laura lying face down on a rocky beach, completely naked. She been murdered."
Does she really say it like Urkel?
She been murdered. Am I doing Urkel's voice?
Close. You're getting close.
And then fake tears.
Yeah.
So, yes, yeah, so she fucks shit up for her dad there.
Yeah, she's being a quite the rebellious teen in her own way.
Yeah. So Bobby and Mike are at the sheriff's department. "Have you straightened her out yet?" Bobby says to Mike about Donna. And Mike says he can't figure it out. And then Bobby says, "I've got her figured. We are looking at some freaking biker. Some freaking biker is going to get his head busted open." Lucy's listening, typing this down. Bobby figures it out. He quits talking. They walk out. Bobby encounters his parents on the way out, and he's a total jerk to his dad, Major Briggs, which is really lame because Major Briggs is awesome.
Yeah,
So.
that's you don't get much of Major Briggs in this episode at all, but if you've seen the show, you know what we're talking about. He's an ace character.
So Agent Cooper questions Donna. Donna attempts to make up a story about a woman hiker with a backpack who shot the film on their behalf.
He doesn't believe it for a second.
No, but her acting's awesome.
Yeah, she does a really good job. I think I would have been convinced.
Yeah. He asks her who she is protecting, and Donna does not give it up. He excuses her, and Donna leaves in tears. He's kind to her. He does, his completely different way of treating her than how he treated Bobby.
Well, he can tell certain things about the personality from those interactions. He knows
Yeah.
Bobby's an asshole, and he knows Donna's just trying to protect somebody that she obviously cares about.
Just seeing how they both react to the video. The sheriff brings in Lucy so she can report what she heard in great detail. But Agent Cooper has already learned what Lucy is going to tell him, and he shows them the reflection in Laura's eye on the video. Cut to James and his bike. He is mournful out in the taiga.
On the what?
The taiga, the taiga, Taiga.
What is
It's
that?
like a landscape, and it's usually in like northern climates. Probably more like Scandinavia, but I just thought it fit.
Okay, I'll go with it. I didn't know if you were making some sort of joke about a tiger.
No.
And
So, were you about to say something though?
I think I was just going to take another swing at the emo biker motif, but we can carry on.
So now the Norwegians are making a mass exodus, and Audrey watches with mischievous glee at the train car. Sheriff and Cooper view the scene of the crime, blood and rags and a hammer. Is it a hammer?
I don't remember.
We should know. And a small dirt mound with a half of a gold heart necklace. The paper with there's a piece of newspaper print with "Fire Walk With Me" written in blood. Now back to James and his hog. He is looking at the other half of the heart
That we just saw.
that we just saw, and he's looking at it tearfully.
Didn't Coop
But he had
say?
a really manly, now he didn't have like a little delicate chain. It was like a leather.
Yeah, it was on like a leather strap or something like
Yeah,
that.
forget
Or
what those are called or something. There's a word.
now, in that scene previous to that, Cooper says that if we find the other half of this necklace, we find the killer.
Right.
So, and we know that James didn't do it. Even if we didn't know already that James didn't do it, you probably have an idea that James didn't do it.
Yeah. I don't know if I would have ever thought he did it. I don't remember
No,
ever thinking he did it.
I didn't either.
So at the Horns, tea time, lunchtime, not sure, sometime with teacups and
Sometime in
bread.
the afternoon.
Audrey and her mother are sitting in the dining room area while Johnny Horn bangs his head, which is doffed in a ceremonial headdress, and he bangs his head into a playhouse.
And I guess the gist of the scene is that Laura's usually comes over and works with him because he's obviously developmentally challenged.
Right.
And so this is one of the ways that Laura impacted the community. She gave of her time to be with people who are less fortunate than her. And this guy Johnny's waiting for Laura to come over and hang out with him for a little while, and she's not coming.
It's been his routine for a long time, so he's not handling this very well.
And neither is the mom.
No, she's not. She's being a little
And
bitch.
Audrey seems rather indifferent to the whole ordeal. She's just kind of like sitting there.
She looks upset to me.
She does?
Yeah.
Okay. I guess. Yeah.
Next scene, Cooper and Sheriff walk into the Twin Peaks local bank conference room. A large deer head lays upon the conference table. It had fell. So they are taking a look inside her safety deposit box, and there's a copy of Flesh World. There's over $10,000 in cash, and Cooper checks a page that has been marked in the Flesh World and has a picture of Ronette, which is circled, and there is also a picture of Leo's truck. I was just trying to like put myself in Laura's shoes. Like, she gets the safety deposit box. I understand the money.
Right.
And I could see that Flesh World would probably be used as maybe some sort of leverage against somebody. But why would Ronette's picture be circled and marked specifically? Like, why wasn't Leo's truck circled? But why was Ronette's picture circled? Like, for Laura. It's not like she would knew that.
I think it's because it wasn't her copy of Flesh World. And if she is using it for leverage, she got it from somebody else.
Leo?
Yeah, maybe. And she put it in the safety deposit box in case she ever had to use it against him. And the thing that I liked best about this scene is just aside from the whole Twin Peaks weirdness of having a deer head on the table, and they just say, "Oh, well, it fell off the wall. It was mounted," you know. But that was just kind of funny. But when they pull out the Fleshworld magazine, Cooper gets this wicked smile on his face. But it's not because he's going to see nudie stuff. It's because he sees the pages bent and he sees a clue.
Or a revelation of some truth or evidence.
Yeah, that's what gets him going. Not that he's going to see some nudie pics, you know. So, which makes him different than probably 99.9% of the male population on the planet, you know. But it's what makes him such a good character.
He's an icon. He's kind of like the perfect
Yeah, that's that. It's
male.
unattainable.
It
It, it
is.
it's really unattainable as a role model, I guess.
So, we see a picture of Leo's truck, which we cut to the actual truck. And this is now we're seeing Leo and Shelley together.
Oh, geez.
And Leo wants to help discerning the difference between the cigarette butts and the ashtray. He's like, "Shelley, come over here and sit with me so we can look at these cigarette butts."
I never gave a lot of thought to this scene, but after I watched it this time, I kind of, it's a, the only thing that makes this scene watchable is Mechanomics acting. That's it. If it wasn't for that, if it, anybody else was in this scene, it would just be left on the cutting room floor. Because, and Eric DeRay, he's got better as time went on. You know what I mean? He became one of the, characters that a lot of comedy evolved from, but also just that was fun to watch on the screen because he had a lot going for that character. But here at the beginning stages of this character, it's just, and you see this a lot in pilots. I'm not singling him out. You know what I mean? It's like, I mean, if you look at any show, you know what I mean? The very first episode has these unfleshed out characters and stuff like that. They're not who they're going to be. And he's got the little ringlet of hair coming down, and later on he keeps it all slicked back, thank God. But
After
his
seeing that Donahue special too, it's
yeah, we saw a Donahue special on YouTube the other day where, and I think it was from either 1989 or 1990, where they Donahue had all the main actors, or five or six of the main actors from the show, and they had Eric DeRay on there. He was actually the only guy, right? Or was Ray Wise on there?
no, Dana Ashbrook.
Oh, Dana Ashbrook. And Eric DeRay had his hair down, and it was just, it looked like he had two or three different perms going on. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was just poodle hair crazy. I mean,
It was a spiral perm that was popular back in those days.
ooh, yeah. I had long hair back then, but I never did anything like that. That's just beyond good taste. So anyway.
Think that might have been his first acting job. I'm not really quite sure, but I don't think he had a lot of experience behind him as far as acting. So moving on. So yes, he does not want her smoking more than one brand of cigarette because he needs to know that nobody else is in the house, basically. And if he finds another brand of cigarettes, he's going to snap her neck like a twig.
Now, just as an aside, do you think that they had like some sort of problem with trademarks? They didn't want to say brand names in the show because he says, "You smoke this kind of cigarettes, but here is this kind of cigarette in the ashtray." Why couldn't he have said, "Look, you smoke Camels, and I'm seeing some Marlboro butts in here. What's going on?"
It just seems like people that would be product placement, so it seems like these companies would want you to say it, so I don't think they would be.
I would think so. But then I'd, you know, even if they had a problem with it, you could just make up a name so that it sounded more realistic, you know?
Well, I mean, there's also like made up names like Morley's that we saw in Walking Dead, and that's a brand of cigarettes that you find in television and movies a lot, like you find Acme. So it's just a I don't know why they didn't do that either.
Was just curious.
Norma gives Big Ed a call. She feels terrible, and they decide to meet at the local roadhouse later that night. He looks out the window and sees Nadine testing out her new drapes. At the town meeting, Cooper and Truman discuss snowshoe rabbits. Cooper asks who is the babe, and he's referring to Josie Packard. This gives us some kind of background of characters because Truman's given background to Cooper. And we learn a little bit about the Packard family background, about Josie's late husband, who's Catherine Martell's brother. And also, when prompted, there's some background given about Benjamin Horne because he also enters the scene. And we know he's after her land, Josie Packard's land. So then we also see the log lady for the first time. She's flipping the light switch on and off and she's shushing the crowd.
I like how she's introduced because Cooper says, "Who's the lady with the log?" And Truman says, "That's the log lady." Like, Like anybody else would be like, "Are you serious, man? Are you pulling my leg?"
So the mayor Milford has a failed intro, and then Cooper is then introduced by Sheriff Truman, and he addresses Twin Peaks. He talks of Teresa Banks being the first victim that they know of, and they're thinking that this is the same killer that killed Teresa Banks has also killed Laura Palmer. He says that there's a chance that the murderer is from Twin Peaks, and he suggests a temporary curfew for the young, and he cautions them that these crimes occurred at night. Cut to a quick shot of the stoplight at Sparkwood and 21, swaying in the night wind. Doc Hayward talks to his wife about the woes of the Palmer family. He also talks the brutality of Laura's murder. He tells his wife some details of the crime scene, specifically the half of the heart, that necklace that was left behind. Donna is listening to all of this. She hears him say that they think that the killer has the other half.
This is where she hears the her dad saying that they figured out that whoever has the other half of the necklace is going to be pinned as the killer.
Right.
So that's why that's the impetus of her wanting to, kind of get out of the house and go see, because obviously there's a curfew and her dad's not going to let her out of the house anyway.
No. So shortly after Donna leaves the house, Mike and Bobby show up at the Haywards' residence. Bobby tells Mike to not take any oink oink off that pretty pig. And that's because they couldn't say profanity. They couldn't use any profane language.
So was he going to call it "Don't take any shit from that bitch"? Is
I don't know
that
what they were going to use, but this is what
they came
David
up with?
Lynch or they came up with on, it might have been Mark Frost came up with on the fly. And it's, I think, better.
So yeah, I can see. Any time that you don't use profanity, I use profanity a lot in my day-to-day life in the podcast. I haven't used it a whole lot in this particular podcast in this particular hour, but it's coming up. If you've never listened to No Shit before, I do cuss a lot, and so does Em. But any time that you can kind of circumvent that and use more creative speech, I think it works out better. Mike and Bobby go to Donna's house, I'm assuming, because they're trying to get the name of the guy who filmed the video of the picnic out of her so they can go bash his head in like they said they were going to do because they don't know who it is.
Right. So Doc Hayward reluctantly goes to fetch Donna and Harriet. She says the
She's trying admirably to stall, but it's not
Yeah.
working.
I like she goes the best laid plans of mice and men, and then she gives Donna up pretty quick.
Well, she's kind of backed into a
Yeah,
corner. What
she
can she
is.
do, really? Unless she's like
I
gonna
don't blame
pretend
her.
that
I don't
she's in
blame
the
her.
closet,
Yeah. So Doc Hayward tells Mike that Donna is not home, and Mike says ominously, "Oh, we'll find her.
Well,
Don't you worry about that."
he asks him. He says, "Do you happen to know where she is? Do you have any idea where she could have gone?" He's like, "Oh, don't worry, we'll find her." It's like no dad is gonna let some teenage guy say that about his teenage daughter and then walk away in one piece,
Well, he did that, and he walked away in one piece.
That's what I'm saying. That's my way of saying I didn't like that part of the scene because it's unbelievable.
Well, I don't think Doc Hayward could take him. And
Maybe.
it's not in his nature.
Yeah, I believe more that it's not in his nature because dads tend to get like superpowers in those situations. Kind of like a mom lifting up a car when her baby's trapped under it. Same principle.
She could tell Doc Hayward did not like him. And so he and Doc Hayward calls the cops. But anyway, so Mike and Bobby take off toward the roadhouse. They just know that's where she's going, I guess.
Yeah. It, I mean,
I guess because it's the biker club.
I suppose, yeah. Maybe that's where they were going to go anyway. If they didn't have, like, that was their ultimate destination, but they figured they could stop by Donna's house and try to get it out of her,
So Doc Hayward contacts Truman about Donna. There's an all points placed on her. Cooper then says, "Of course Donna snuck out. How else is she going to lead us to that biker?" So now we're at the roadhouse, and we have the wonderful voice of Julie Cruise at a normal talk of their current state of their relationship and about Norma's husband Hank, who's in the joint
And
for manslaughter.
this is where like it really hits home that Twin Peaks is all about the duality. Everything about this show is about a double life. I mean, even the title, Twin, the Twin Peaks, the double R diner, the doppelgangers,
Mike and
Mike and
Bobby.
Bobby,
Bob and Mike.
Bob and Mike. Yeah, it just every single person has a secret or a secret lover or somebody else, and some people have multiple things going on.
Laura and Maddie.
Yeah, there's just so much duality and reciprocation, or however you want it, whatever term you want to tag to it, that's going on here, and it's the major theme of the show, because even Ed Hurley, and this is why I say it hits home, and you start to realize it, because you think, here's this, like, a lot of people were wearing flannel, but I mean, it's this flannel clad salt of the earth, you know, type guy who's running his own business and everything, and he just seems like that perfect uncle type person, and then you realize that he's on the other side of town, you know, with a woman who's not his wife. Of course, there's more backstory to this, and I don't blame him, but it is what it is.
So Truman and Cooper are on stakeout outside the roadhouse. Cooper is whittling a whistle. Mike and Bobby arrive. There's bound to be trouble. Some of the local bikers notice Bobby and Mike as they enter, and they do not seem to like them. Donna then arrives on her bicycle, and Truman calls for backup. Donna walks into the roadhouse, and Mike yells her name like a dick. He walks her and manhandles her. She yells for him to take his hands off. Ed jumps in to help her and is taken down way too quickly.
Oh yeah, for a big guy like that to just take like one or two punches from a teenager, something's up.
He didn't even like he barely he was starting to slouch before they he even got fully into it, and we know why.
This is explained next episode, yeah.
So Joey Paulson escorts her out of the roadhouse and is taking her to James Hurley. Now, I was talking about that treasure hunt. So is this like all James Hurley like saying, meet me at the roadhouse, but he's got like this guy there who was supposed Joey Paulson who was supposed to meet with Donna and take her to where he's gonna be. It's so
It seems overly convoluted,
yes.
but the only thing that I can think of in Hurley's defense is that he tells her to meet at the roadhouse. He gave the note to somebody, so there's already a third party involved. So if somebody's following her, or if, you know, Ed tells somebody else that they're supposed to meet there, she could be followed. So, but if this guy runs her out the back door, puts her on the back of his bike, and then takes her to wherever James is, then everything's okay. It's still pretty convoluted, and there's still a lot of variables, you know, that get thrown in there. But that's what I'm thinking.
So, meanwhile, the fight continues in the roadhouse. Truman and Cooper follow Donna and the biker. Next scene. They've lost Donna and Joey. Cooper's not too concerned, and he's smelling the Douglas firs. Then they hear a motorbike, and they take off towards the sound, which is, an access road 5 miles back. Meanwhile, Donna and James are now together. Joey has left. James tells Donna he thinks he will get locked up because he does not have an alibi. He was with Laura last night. He says she was acting all kinds of crazy, and he tells her that some guy got killed and that Bobby has said that he killed him. At least that's what Laura said.
I don't have anything to add. It was just a
Well, we know the answer to that in
Right, yeah.
Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me. Half the time, he says half the time she wasn't making any sense, and that when they got to Sparkwood in 21, she hopped off the bike and ran off. And that was the last time that he saw her.
This is why I tell listeners to stay on the bike.
So Donna holds him and tells him it's not his fault, and they begin to kiss. They pull away, startled, but then they begin to kiss some more, and there's sirens in the distance. Donna tells him to give her the other half of the necklace. But he suggests they should bury it, and they do right there in front of the owls, and which is stupid.
Yeah, you should. Everybody knows in Twin Peaks you don't do anything in front of owls. Come on.
They buried the necklace, and you had mentioned earlier about Laura actually being a physical presence between James and Donna.
Right.
And so now this is like where they're actually burying it. They're burying it for
Legal reasons.
To hide it, to
Right.
protect James, but it's also like burying Laura too. It's like symbolic, or that connection
Good
with
catch,
James and
yeah.
Laura too. So I think
Yeah.
that just kind of just adds to what you've already said. So that's a
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that the first time around either. That's another good insight. It's a literal representation of what they're doing to what Laura was to them. And I mean, of course, they're going to bury her real body, you know, in a couple of episodes. I forget which one it's in, but yeah, that's pretty good.
After it is buried, he takes her home, attempts to anyway, but it's not long before Coop and Truman catch up with them. Later, Donna's released to her dad, James is locked up, and so are Mike and Bobby.
You know, what's interesting about the scene where Coop and Truman pull them over is Truman's like, get away from the bike, get away from the girl, put your hands behind your head, blah, 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 the whole nine yards. And then Cooper is using his like his
Whistle.
FBI
Oh.
stealthing skills, or what, not stealthing skills, but his sleuthing skills rather, to figure out long distance that this guy didn't do it either, and that he's not dangerous. He's just like, I mean, is he that good of a judge of character that he's able to just tell, like, I see this guy 20 feet away, I'm pretty sure he didn't do it. Don't worry about him. He's good. He's right, but.
So Donna and Doc Hayward have a little talk in the car. He's a nice dad.
Yeah, he handled this in a very how you'd want your father to handle this
But
way.
Donna is a good daughter. So, and he even says, we're so grateful to have a daughter like you, meaning glad you're not like Laura, because as you learn more and more about Laura, Laura was a wild girl. So, and
You know
that's.
what? That's good. I didn't actually get that out of that scene. I thought he was just, commenting or complimenting her because she is a good daughter. I didn't take it as you're not like that crazy girl, Laura, who got herself killed last night. But you're right, though.
So Cooper and Sheriff sit down in the conference room, and there's an array of donuts. And Cooper asks about where he should stay, and Truman recommends the Great Northern. Mike and Bobby taunt James. Bobby starts barking. I'm not sure if it's barking or if it's some stupid football thing. It kind of reminded me of it could be either.
This scene struck me as silly the first time I ever saw it, and it struck me the same way ever since. I've never not felt a little bit cringy at this scene. And I know I understand what's going on and why they're doing it. I just felt like it was a poor choice. That's all.
It's weird because the first time, James gets put into the room or the jail cell, you get a quick scene of that, and Bobby and Mike are looking at James, and Bobby opens his mouth. Like, and it has a close up of him opening his mouth. It's weird. And the only thing, and this is going to be stupid, I might edit it out, but because it's animalistic, what he does later with like barking or whatever, I wonder if it's like, sometimes animals have these like bigger olfactory glands like up in their noses. And so if he's like tasting the scent of James.
Like he's somehow a predator and he's using one of his heightened senses to taste the air around him.
Basically.
I just think this scene would have been a little bit more effective if they just kind of stared at him menacingly and they just showed James over there being looking scared, and kind of hunched over, like he's like slouching while he's,
He
standing
looked
there.
like a cornered animal to me.
Yeah. But I mean, you've got bars. I mean, nobody's getting out and nobody's getting into the other cell,
But
so.
eventually they're all going to get out at some point, and Bobby's making threats, like he's like a matter of time. And James was just told by Laura that Bobby's killed someone.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That could be weighing on. But he does have the actual real greaser gang of the town behind him,
That's
though.
true. And the Bookhouse Boys.
Not the Sosh's pretending to be. Well, he's the only one, really, because
Yeah, he's the only
the
Sosh
other
pretending to
Sosh
be
is
a
living up
greaser.
to the
Yes, Sosh
Sosh standards.
standard. So,
Bet you guys didn't know there was such a thing as a Sosh standard.
so Sheriff Truman visits Josie Packard. They are lovers. Catherine spies and tells someone on the phone that he is here again. This someone is Ben Horn, and he says, "Let's get together and talk about it." Truman and Josie look over the area where Laura's body was found and talk about her murder. Sarah Palmer is at home, and she has, I think she's on the couch. Is she on the
Yes,
couch
she's on
again?
the couch.
So Sarah Palmer is at home on her couch, and she has a vision of a gloved hand taking the necklace, and she screams. And that shit still gives me chills.
Yeah, it's just an extrapolation of what she was doing before.
Well, also seeing the gloved hand like do that mysteriously in the night,
Oh yeah, like you're
the
just having a
combination
vision.
of her
Like how would she know that?
and then, that mysterious hand in the night.
End
So,
of the pilot. I'm glad that we're, No Ship Network is podcasting on this show, because if it wasn't for this show, we wouldn't have a podcast at all. And it's not because the two are intrinsically linked, our love of podcasting and our love of Twin Peaks, but we never would have got into TV shows, because both, Em and I, when this was one of the first things that she got me into, when we met each other. And it was, well, David Lynch in general, but Twin Peaks specifically. And I never really had an interest in TV shows before that, and neither did you, if I remember. And for the longest time, we didn't watch any TV shows besides Twin Peaks. We felt like this was like the beginning and the end, the be all and end all of TV shows. And it was the first show that did, you name it, however many things out there that were revolutionary about television, this is a show that broke all the ground. And I know there's other shows that people point to in the 80s and 70s that were really good. And there were a lot of good shows back then, I've come to see in hindsight, since I'm not so TV phobic anymore. But I think that Twin Peaks is the first one that mixed everything that I find to be compelling in television and really showed what could be done. And it opened the floodgates. And there's better shows out there than Twin Peaks, but if it wasn't for Twin Peaks, they wouldn't have existed. I feel like Twin Peaks is to good TV what Black Sabbath is to heavy metal. So that's I can't put it any more put any more of a fine point on it than that.
It's the grandfather of fine TV.
Yeah, the grandfather of good television. That's a good way to put it.
I mean, since this is the pilot episode, we had a lot more ground to cover, and we could just talk more as time goes on about our relationship to the show.
Yeah, we could throw in little anecdotes here and there.
We'll just keep this one a little bit shorter, this podcast, and we'll talk more later. So, all right. So if you want to be a part, if you want to get on our ship and join, be along for the ride, go to noship.net, and we have various means that you can contact us. You can join our Facebook page and write to us there. You can go to our Twitter page, and you can also write to us at our Gmail account. That is noship.net, NOSHIP.net. Okay, that's it for now. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve. I mean it like it is.
Like it sounds. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.